So we tend to think of balance sheets as, the ultimate arbiters of objective truth.
Right, just cold, hard math.
Exactly. You look at the ledger, you tally the debits on the left, credits on the right, and the bottom line gives you the snapshot of reality that you can supposedly trust.
Supposedly being the operative word there.
Yeah. But what happens when the entity sending you the bill is the exact same empire that spent centuries extracting your resources and, well, enslaving your ancestors?
It's just a staggering proposition when you hear it spoken aloud.
It really is. And we saw this happen recently. In July of 2026, a former British Home Secretary actually suggested that former colonies should be the ones repaying Britain for the infrastructure of the empire.
Right, that was Suella Braverman. And her comment, it perfectly encapsulates this deeply entrenched historical worldview.
Yeah, she was responding to Jamaica's renewed push for reparatory justice,
She
right?
was, yeah. She basically argued that the empire provided investment, democratic institutions, legal frameworks. So her implication was that if anyone owes anyone, the formerly colonized nations actually owe the British state for building their modern societies.
Which is just, it immediately collided with reality.
Oh, absolutely.
Barbados Prime Minister Mia Motley rejected it outright. She stated unequivocally that the descendants of the enslaved should not be asked to pay for the machinery that oppressed them.
A very sharp, necessary pushback.
Definitely. And that friction is exactly what we are unpacking today. We are doing a deep dive into a profoundly thought-provoking essay published in July 2026.
A really fascinating piece of work.
It is. It's titled, The Sacrificed Are Told to Thank the Altar: Colonial Debt Reversal and the Life-Coherent Meaning of Reparations. And it's by Dr. Bechara Saheli.
And I think it's important to state upfront how we're approaching this text.
Yes, exactly, because we are looking at this purely as an intellectual exploration for you, the listener.
Right, because obviously colonialism, reparations,
Yeah.
these are highly charged, highly political topics.
Very sensitive issues. And we are not here to take a political side or endorse a specific viewpoint or, play pundit.
Not at all.
Our mission is purely analytical. We want to impartially map out Dr. Saley's logic, his historical accounting, and the structural solutions he proposes, just to ensure you understand exactly what the author is arguing.
Yeah, to see how he constructs this argument from the ground up.
So we're going to cover this radical redefinition of debt, the difference between personal guilt and institutional responsibility, and this new concept called the reparatory commons. But first, let's talk about the author himself, because his background is so unique.
Yeah, what is immediately apparent when you dive into this text is his specific lens. Dr. Saley is not an economist,
Right.
nor is he a traditional historian. He actually holds degrees in biology and internal medicine.
He's a practicing physician.
Exactly. And that medical background fundamentally alters the vocabulary of his argument.
It really does. He doesn't approach the legacy of colonialism by just, trying to balance a financial spreadsheet.
No, he approaches it like a systemic illness.
Oh, I like that framing.
He's looking at the anatomy of a society, diagnosing what vital capacities were damaged, and then figuring out the structural therapies required to restore the actual conditions of life.
Which is such a refreshing way to look at historical justice. And there's another really fascinating modern detail about how this essay was written.
Oh, the AI transparency notes.
Yes, I found that detail incredibly compelling. The paper explicitly states that the text was developed through a sustained dialogue between Dr. Saley and ChatGPT.
It's a fascinating reflection of where academic drafting is heading in 2026.
It is,
Yeah.
because he makes it clear that he provided the initiating questions, the ethical framework, the conceptual direction, and he assumed total responsibility for all the factual claims.
Right. You just use the AI purely for conceptual synthesis.
Yeah, like a structural sounding board. It's just a transparent look at how modern thinkers are using these tools to refine complex arguments, without surrendering human accountability.
Which is perfect, because accountability is the core theme of the essay itself.
Exactly. So let's get back to Braverman's comments.
Right, because those comments weren't just some off-the-cuff political gaffe. They represent a very specific ideological mechanism.
Which Dr. Selle calls colonial debt reversal.
Yes.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because colonial debt reversal, it sounds like a technical economic term.
It does.
But in practice, the essay describes it as a complete moral and historical inversion.
A total inversion. The extracting power, the empire that siphoned the wealth and labor, casts itself as the benevolent creditor.
And the societies that endured the dispossession are cast as ungrateful debtors.
Exactly. It basically takes conquest and rebrands it as investment.
Right, taking compulsory forced labor and describing it as like civic development.
The psychological gymnastics required to maintain that narrative are just immense.
You'd have to strip away the context of coercion entirely.
You do. By focusing solely on the physical artifacts left behind, the ports, the railways, the administrative buildings, the imperial narrative completely isolates the expenditure from the extraction.
Right. I was trying to conceptualize how this logic operates on like a human scale for our listeners.
No, I'd love to hear this.
So it's almost as if a hacker stole your identity, drained your entire life savings, and used all your money to buy themselves a massive mansion.
Okay, tracking with you.
Then, decades later, when their estate is settling their accounts, they have the audacity to send you an invoice for the plumbing upgrades they installed while living in the mansion.
Wow.
Claiming they, quote, invested in your infrastructure.
That analogy actually captures the precise mechanism of his critique.
Right, because the stolen identity and drained savings represent the extraction of wealth, land, and human labor.
And the mansion is the imperial state.
Exactly. So the plumbing upgrades are the colonial infrastructure. Colonial debt reversal is the estate sending you an invoice for the pipes, completely ignoring whose stolen wealth paid for the house in the first place.
It's spot on. But, you know, we should test the boundaries of this framework.
Yeah, let's play devil's advocate for a second, because I want to push back on that analogy slightly.
Go for it.
Let's look at that plumbing, the physical infrastructure of the colonies. If the British Empire built deep water ports, if they paved roads across a territory, built schools, established legal courts.
The brick and mortar.
Right. Doesn't the sheer physical existence of those structures count for something?
It's a common question.
Because when independence was achieved, those newly sovereign nations didn't rip up the roads. They drove their own trucks on them. They used the ports to trade. Doesn't the utility of that infrastructure provide a net positive that wouldn't have existed otherwise?
That raises a really important point, and it's one that the essay spends a significant amount of time deconstructing.
How does he address it?
Well, Dr. Saley doesn't dispute that empires built roads, ports, and schools. The physical reality of the infrastructure is undeniable.
The road is there.
The road is there. But he argues that we have to interrogate the intent and the function of those structures at the time they were built.
Ah, okay.
A port constructed specifically to export sugar or cotton harvested by enslaved labor, that is not a neutral public works project.
No, it's not.
Its meaning is entirely tethered to the extractive economy it was designed to serve.
So it's an architecture of extraction.
Exactly.
If you look at the layout of colonial railways, for example, they rarely connect major domestic populations to foster internal trade.
Never. They almost always run in a straight line from a mining region or an agricultural heartland directly to a seaport.
To get the goods out, the infrastructure was built to facilitate an exit strategy for the wealth.
That is a perfect way to phrase it. The roads were arteries to bleed the resources out, not veins to circulate prosperity within.
Oh, that's a powerful image.
And the same goes for the institutions. The courts were established to protect the property rights of the colonizers.
Which critically included the legal ownership of human beings.
Exactly. A bureaucracy set up to collect punitive taxes and discipline a subjugated labor force? You can't retroactively sanitize that by calling it institution building.
Right. But what about the fact that independent nations later used those roads and ports?
Dr. Saheeli has an incredibly striking response to that. He writes, quote, "Survival is not evidence of benevolence. Adaptation is not consent."
Wait, read that again. That is really striking.
Survival is not evidence of benevolence. Adaptation is not consent. That is really the philosophical anchor of this entire section.
I see.
The ability of a formerly colonized people to inherit a coercive structure and ingeniously repurpose it for their own flourishing.
Right, because they had no other choice.
Exactly. Doing that does not prove that the structure was built for their benefit. To go back to your analogy, the fact that you eventually reclaimed your stolen funds, moved into the hacker's mansion, and used the plumbing
doesn't mean the hacker built the house as a gift to me.
Precisely.
So the decisive question isn't whether a paved road exists today. The question is who financed its construction through uncompensated labor?
Who was displaced to clear the land for it?
And were the capital generated by the goods traveling on that road ultimately accumulated?
Yes, exactly.
Wow. Okay, so once we accept that the physical remnants of empire were tools of extraction rather than public goods, it forces us into the next massive friction point in this debate.
And this is usually where the conversation gets really difficult. the complexities of time, generations, and inherited responsibility.
Yeah, this is the hurdle where most conversations about reparatory justice completely stall out.
Almost instantly.
Because even if you, the listener, accept everything we just discussed, that the infrastructure was extractive, that the system was deeply unjust, you will inevitably ask a very practical question.
Which is?
How can we ask people living today who had absolutely nothing to do with building those extractive ports or running those plantation economies to foot the bill?
Right. The perpetrators are gone. The immediate victims are gone.
Exactly. This takes us from historical logistics directly into the philosophical debate over modern guilt.
And what is really fascinating here is that Dr. Sakelli completely agrees with the premise of that objection.
He does.
He does. He doesn't dismiss the anxiety of the modern citizen. He validates it.
That's surprising.
He states unequivocally that personal guilt is not inherited. No individual born today carries a moral stain or a personal culpability for crimes committed centuries before they took their first breath.
Well, that fundamentally reframes the discourse. Because the most common political tactic used to derail reparations is to frame it as an attack on the moral character of modern citizens.
Exactly, making people feel personally attacked.
But if personal guilt dies with the individual, how does the essay mathematically or philosophically justify a continuing debt?
The author argues that our public debate is paralyzed because we constantly conflate four entirely distinct categories.
Okay, what are they?
We treat personal guilt, institutional responsibility, accumulated advantage, and unrepaired harm as if they are all the exact same thing.
And they are not.
They are definitely not.
Let's break those down because decoupling them seems essential to his argument. We've established that personal guilt is tied to the individual actor.
Right.
But the second category, institutional responsibility, that operates on a completely different timeline.
It does. We are talking about continuing bodies, sovereign states, multinational corporations, legacy banks, prestigious universities.
These entities possess a sort of legal and structural immortality.
They exist far beyond a human lifespan. And this brings us to the third category, accumulated advantage.
Okay, accumulated advantage. What does he mean by that?
This is the endowment of wealth, authority, land, and global market position that is built up over centuries and passed down within those institutions.
I see.
And then the fourth category is the mirror image of that, unrepaired harm.
Which is the compounding deficit left behind in the extracted societies.
Yes. The generational impact on public health, ecological stability, and economic sovereignty.
So the essay points out this glaring hypocrisy in how modern society views these continuing institutions, right?
Oh, a massive hypocrisy.
We never question the continuity of a state when it works in our favor.
Never.
When a new government takes power, they don't say, well, the previous administration built the Navy and negotiated these lucrative trade treaties, so we have no right to them.
No, they seamlessly inherit the assets, the borders, and the accumulated advantages.
Corporations do the exact same thing. A modern bank retains its property, its brand equity, its capital reserves across generations of CEOs and shareholders.
Universities preserve endowments that were seeded centuries ago.
Right. The legal framework of our entire global economy relies on the concept that institutions have an unbroken continuity.
And the text argues that you cannot coherently affirm institutional continuity when it conveys legitimacy and wealth, but conveniently declare that continuity broken the moment it conveys responsibility.
Wow. You cannot inherit the estate while legally refusing its liabilities.
Exactly. So if a legacy bank built its foundational capital by insuring slave ships in the 18th century. The CEO sitting in the corner office today bears zero personal guilt for slavery.
Right. They didn't do it.
But the bank, as a continuing corporate entity, holds accumulated advantage from that specific historical violence.
Therefore, the institution holds the responsibility to repair it.
Precisely. The argument shifts the focus from the individual soul to the institutional ledger.
That makes a lot of sense for a bank or a university. But I want to bring up another original pushback here.
Okay, let's hear.
When we talk about sovereign states paying reparations, it is funded by the modern taxpayer.
True.
And this naturally leads to that friction we just talked about. If I, as a modern citizen, am paying taxes to a state that is fulfilling a historical reparatory obligation, aren't I still functionally being punished for a crime I didn't commit?
That is the exact tension.
If my paycheck is being docked to pay this historical debt, it feels like a personal penalty.
Dr. Sally addresses this by asking us to reconsider the nature of civic duty.
How so?
Well, when your tax dollars go to service a national debt incurred by a war fought 50 years ago, or, to pay out a settlement for environmental damage caused by a government agency in the 1980s, you don't view it as a personal moral punishment.
That's true. I don't feel personally guilty for a war I wasn't alive for, even if my taxes pay for the veterans' benefits.
Exactly. You view it as an obligation of the state to which you belong. You are participating in the balancing of a public ledger.
So it's the difference between paying a personal moral fine and participating in a public accounting correction.
That's a great way to put it.
That shift in perspective is crucial because it really lowers the emotional temperature of the debate.
It takes the defensive ego out of it.
But if we are talking about balancing a public ledger, it forces us to look at how the imperial accountants were keeping the books in the first place.
Right. And this brings us to the concept of the falsified balance sheet.
The falsified balance sheet.
The essay posits that the only way colonial debt reversal survives as a political talking point is because it relies on a historically illiterate, incomplete set of accounting books.
Because the imperial narrative exclusively records expenditures.
Yes. It logs the cost of the colonial administration, the salaries of the governors, the military garrisons deployed to protect trade routes, the capital spent on railways.
And it presents this column of expenses as evidence of a massive transfer of value from the metropole to the colony.
But look at what is deliberately omitted from the other side of that ledger.
Everything.
Pretty much. The accounting entirely erases the appropriated land. It zeroes out the uncompensated labor of millions of enslaved and subjugated people over centuries.
It ignores the extracted minerals, the exported agricultural wealth, the devastating ecological degradation.
And the violent suppression of indigenous technological development.
So the books only balance because the vast majority of human life and ecological vitality has been excluded from the spreadsheet.
Precisely. And the essay provides a historically devastating example of this falsified accounting.
Yes. Let's look at Britain's Emancipation Settlement of 1833. Because when the British Parliament finally abolished slavery in its colonies, how did they handle the financial ledger of emancipation?
What's fascinating here is that this is perhaps one of the most revealing moments in imperial history.
Right.
When Parliament passed the Slavery Abolition Act, they recognized an immense amount of property was being legally dissolved.
And property in quotes, meaning human beings.
Yes. So, to stabilize the economy, they authorized a massive financial compensation package. It amounted to £20 million, which was a staggering percentage of the British national budget at the time.
Didn't the government actually have to take out a massive loan to fund it?
They did. A massive loan that they were paying off until 2015.
Wait, really? A loan paid by British taxpayers up until 2015?
Yes.
And who received that £20 million?
The slave owners.
Wow.
The British state compensated the perpetrators for the loss of their forced labor.
Unbelievable.
And the enslaved people, who had endured generations of bodily violence, family separation, and stolen labor, received absolutely nothing in terms of compensation.
And it actually gets worse, because they weren't even granted immediate freedom.
No, they were not. As part of the settlement, the emancipated people were forced into a period of compulsory apprenticeship.
Apprenticeship.
Yes, which basically meant they had to continue working for their former masters, unpaid, for a set number of years to further compensate the owners for the transition.
It takes your breath away to see the mechanics of it laid out so plainly.
It does.
The state recognized the financial injury of the owner losing free labor, but it entirely ignored the human injury of the person who was owned.
What's fascinating here is how the 1833 settlement shatters the myth that slavery was merely a collection of private wrongs committed by, you know, individual bad actors.
Right. It wasn't just a few cruel plantation owners.
No, it was fundamentally a state-sanctioned, state-financed enterprise.
Slavery was upheld by an interlocking structure of governance.
Parliament wrote the laws defining humans as property. The courts rigorously enforced those property claims.
The Royal Navy defended the maritime trade routes.
And the financial centers in London provided the credit and the insurance that allowed the system to scale globally.
It was a massive systemic machine.
Yes. So when someone in the modern era points back to the British Empire and says, look at all the administrative costs we bore, look at the legal frameworks we gifted you,
they are reproducing the exact same accounting logic of 1833.
Exactly. They are counting the expenditure of the empire's power, but making the lives that were consumed by that power completely disappear from the balance sheet.
So a truthful historical accounting demands that both sides of the ledger are recognized.
Mm-hmm.
You have to include both the capital invested and the immense wealth extracted.
You have to measure the administrative costs of empire against the profound human, ecological, and developmental deficits imposed on the colonized societies.
And Dr. Saley argues that once you restore the full account, the claim that former colonies somehow owe a debt to their former extractors collapses under the weight of its own economic absurdity.
It's mathematically impossible to sustain.
The reduction of human beings to property, to a mere column of depreciating assets on a ledger, is incredibly bleak. And here is where it gets really interesting.
Oh, the mythological aspect.
Yes, because to fully articulate the horror of this machinery, Dr. Saley steps away from modern economic terminology and turns to ancient mythological symbols.
Right. He introduces the archetypes of Moloch and Mammon.
Let's explore this metaphorical layer because it gives a completely different texture to the economic arguments we've been having. Who or what are Moloch and Mammon in the context of this essay?
So Moloch is an ancient mythological symbol. It has come to represent any system that demands the sacrifice of life just for the preservation of its own order.
Right.
It is an insatiable deity of consuming fire. A society feeds its own people, its own children, into the furnace so that the system itself can survive.
And what about Mammon?
Mammon, conversely, represents the ultimate pursuit of wealth, elevated into a governing moral value.
Okay.
Mammon is profit, completely detached from the living ecosystems, the human relationships, and the communities from which that wealth was extracted.
And the essay posits that the colonial plantation economy was the perfect, terrifying marriage of these two forces.
Exactly. Human beings were fed into the brutal, grinding machinery of plantation production. Their labor, their health, their reproductive futures, and their constrained lives were physically consumed by the system.
That is the sacrifice to Moloch.
Yes. And meanwhile, the wealth generated from that consumed life was meticulously counted, abstracted into commodities, traded on European exchanges, and compounded into generational fortunes.
And that is Mammon keeping the accounts.
Moloch eats the life, and Mammon counts the coins.
That imagery perfectly contextualizes the title of the essay itself. The sacrificed are told to thank the altar.
It really does.
Based on this mythological framework, how does Dr. Saheli explain the ultimate insult of colonial debt reversal?
The author writes that colonial debt reversal is the final, grotesque inversion of this system.
In what way?
It demands gratitude from the descendants of those whose lives were fed into the furnace. It redescribes the crushing machinery of exploitation as a benevolent, civilizing gift.
So the people who stole labor, literally financed the construction of the altar, are now being told they are deeply in debt for its architecture.
Yes. The text puts it so bluntly, with a quote that I think cuts through all the academic jargon.
Let's hear it.
Prisoners do not owe the jailer for constructing the prison.
Wow. It's an undeniable piece of logic. The enslaved do not owe the plantation owner for organizing the logistics of their forced labor.
No.
And colonized peoples do not owe an empire for building the very infrastructure through which their land and labor were actively drained.
Every system of domination, no matter how brutal, has operating costs.
Right.
The fact that the British Empire had to spend money on administrative overhead to manage its colonies does not transform that domination into benevolence.
Just because the empire bought the bricks for the prison doesn't mean the prisoner should be grateful for the walls.
Precisely.
We have spent this entire time deconstructing the false narratives, the broken ledgers, and the moral inversions. But if gratitude is the wrong response, and if the historical ledger is fundamentally falsified, what is the right response?
What comes next?
Yes. What does actual, meaningful repair look like according to this text? This transitions us from the philosophical diagnosis into Dr. Saley's practical structural prescriptions.
And to understand his solution, we first have to understand how he defines reparations. Because, as the essay points out, the concept of reparations is frequently caricatured in modern political debates.
Very frequently. It gets painted as either a punitive tax based on inherited guilt or as a massive, indiscriminate cash giveaway.
Right. It is often cynically framed as a crude attempt to force innocent modern individuals to pay a financial penalty to other individuals for events that happened centuries ago.
But Dr. Saley rejects all of those mainstream framings, right?
He does entirely. He argues that reparations are not charity. Charity is entirely discretionary. It relies on the fluctuating generosity of the giver.
Okay, so that's not charity.
Reparatory justice is fundamentally different because it arises from a binding obligation to address an uncorrected wrong.
That distinction is key.
Furthermore, he emphasizes that it is not revenge. Revenge seeks to inflict suffering in return for suffering. The sole purpose of repair is to reduce suffering.
So what is his operational definition?
He defines it as life capacity restoration.
Life capacity restoration.
And this is where his background as a physician becomes the central architecture of his theory.
How so?
He argues that the true crime of colonialism wasn't merely the theft of capital. It was the systematic destruction of the capacities through which a society sustains and governs itself.
So it's not just that they took money, it's that they broke the systems.
Exactly. Colonialism actively damaged a region's ability to maintain public health, to educate its populace, to protect its ecological borders, and to develop an autonomous, productive economy.
You know, given that he's a medical doctor, life capacity sounds almost like a medical diagnosis of a society.
It is, absolutely.
Let me test an analogy here. If a patient is severely injured in a catastrophic car accident caused by a negligent driver, and the court awards that patient a massive cash payout, that money is important.
Right. They need the resources.
But the cash itself does not magically fuse the broken bones back together?
No, it doesn't.
If the patient receives the check, but they still have no access to an orthopedic surgeon, no physical therapy, no wheelchair accessible infrastructure in their home, they have not been repaired. They were just a person with a check who is still immobilized. Is that essentially what he is arguing about former colonies?
That analogy perfectly illustrates his point. He is explicit that financial payments cannot fully price the magnitude of stolen freedom, the severing of kinship lines, or the deliberate destruction of indigenous knowledge systems.
So money matters. Material injuries absolutely require material resources to fix them. But in this framework, money is strictly the means of repair, not its final measure.
Exactly. A cash transfer without institutional transformation just leaves the original vulnerability entirely intact.
You might temporarily boost consumption, but the society remains dependent on the very global systems that extracted their wealth in the first place.
The deeper measure of success, the life coherent metric, is whether the structural conditions of life have been actively restored. Have we healed the anatomical damage to the society?
Which brings us to the final and perhaps most crucial part of his argument, the concrete administration of this cure.
The how.
Exactly. How do you deploy reparatory resources in a way that actually restores life capacity rather than just creating a new bureaucratic slush fund?
Dr. Seigle proposes the establishment of what he calls the reparatory commons.
But let's define the mechanics of this. What exactly is a reparatory commons?
So a reparatory commons is a significant pooling of reparatory resources directed explicitly toward building durable, forward-facing institutions.
Okay.
These institutions are created for the shared collective benefit of present and future generations.
So it is fundamentally different from a private payout to an individual.
Very different. And it is distinct from just dumping money into the general treasury of a standard government, where it can be absorbed by immediate debts.
Right.
It is a protected collective capacity designed specifically to repair a historical deficit and build resilience against future shocks.
The essay provides some incredibly specific structural examples of what this would look like, particularly focused on the Caribbean region, right?
Yes. And examining these examples shows exactly how the life capacity approach moves from theory to practice.
What's the first one?
One primary example he gives is the creation of regional public health and pharmaceutical institutes.
Let's pause on that one because it is brilliant.
It really is.
Historically, colonial systems forced these regions to focus entirely on cash crops like sugar, actively suppressing domestic scientific and technological development. By funding a regional pharmaceutical institute through a reparatory commons, you aren't just paying for imported medicine, you are funding the capacity for that region to research, manufacture, and distribute its own therapies.
Exactly. You are breaking the cycle of dependency on foreign pharmaceutical patents.
Patents which, ironically, are often held by corporations in the former colonizing nations.
Right. You are structurally reversing the specific mechanism of colonial harm.
What's another example?
Another example he proposes is funding climate resilient systems for water, food security, and energy.
This is so critical. We know that these island nations and formerly colonized regions face severe existential climate risks.
And what is deeply unjust is that they contributed comparatively little to the historical carbon emissions that are causing this crisis.
But they suffer disproportionately due to the geographic and economic vulnerabilities established during the colonial era.
Exactly. So a reparatory commons dedicated to climate resilience would build fortified water desalination plants, hurricane-resistant agricultural grids, and renewable energy infrastructure.
It is literally building the physical capacity to survive the future.
He also advocates for ecological restoration trusts.
Because the plantation economy was just an ecological disaster.
No, devastating. It involved aggressive deforestation, soil depletion from monocrop agriculture, and the destruction of coastal systems.
So a restoration trust would be a collectively managed fund dedicated to returning degraded lands to health and restoring biodiversity.
Effectively healing the land that was sacrificed to Moloch.
Wow. Another critical piece he mentions is the creation of public interest development banks. How does that fit into the life capacity framework?
Think about how newly independent nations often have to fund their infrastructure today.
We usually have to borrow it.
Right. They are frequently forced to take out high-interest loans from international lenders or organizations like the IMF, which often come with punitive austerity conditions.
Which traps them in a predatory cycle of unpayable debt.
So a repertory development bank would provide capital for essential domestic infrastructure without reproducing those extractive debt cycles.
Yeah.
It restores economic sovereignty.
So the guiding question behind every single one of these proposals is, does this investment protect, restore, or sustainably enlarge the capacities of living persons, communities, and ecosystems?
Yes.
It is a profound paradigm shift. It transforms reparations from a purely backward-looking transaction, just settling an old debt on a ledger, into a forward-building program of structural justice.
It asks what future can be built that was previously stolen.
It is about removing the dependencies that the colonial era installed.
However, we have to acknowledge a very real, practical concern that is often raised when discussing massive transfers of institutional wealth.
Right, the corruption question. I know you, the listener, are probably thinking about this right now.
Mm-hmm.
Couldn't these massive resources simply disappear into corrupt administrative bureaucracies?
It's the first thing people ask.
You establish a multi-billion dollar commons, and it gets siphoned off by political elites, consultants, and contractors, never actually materially improving the daily lives of the marginalized people it was supposed to repair.
It is a highly legitimate fear, and Dr. Sasley does not shy away from it.
How does he safeguard against it?
He explicitly argues that a repertory commons cannot function as an opaque slush fund. The governance of these resources is as important as the resources themselves.
Okay, so how are they governed?
He argues they require radical transparency, deep public participation, and strictly measurable outcomes regarding human and ecological health.
Measurable outcomes.
They must be governed through intergenerational stewardship. If a designated commons does not demonstrably enlarge the living capacities of the people, it is failing its repertory function.
So it has to be actively managed and protected by civil society, not just state bureaucrats.
Exactly. It's a completely different model of civic engagement.
Well, we have covered an immense philosophical and historical landscape today.
We really have.
We started by looking at how the political assertion that colonies owe their former empires is based on a moral inversion colonial debt reversal, which demands that the victims of extraction treat the infrastructure of their oppression as a benevolent gift.
And then we untangle the inheritance trap, clarifying the vital distinction between personal guilt, which vanishes with the individual,
yeah,
and institutional responsibility, which persists alongside accumulated advantage of states and corporations.
We examine the falsified balance sheet of imperial history using the 1833 Emancipation Settlement to reveal how the state financially bailed out the perpetrators of slavery while completely erasing the human lives they consumed.
We engaged with the powerful mythology of Moloch and Mammon to understand the spiritual and economic cruelty of a system that demanded human sacrifice for profit.
And finally, we explored a radical redefinition of reparations, shifting away from indiscriminate cash payouts toward the structural restoration of life capacities through the repertory commons.
It is an incredibly coherent, structurally rigorous way of looking at historical justice.
It takes it out of the realm of abstract guilt and places it firmly in the realm of practical civic repair. And as we wrap up this deep dive, I want to ask you, the listener, to carry this framework with you as you navigate the modern world. Take a hard look at the continuing institutions that surround you.
The government that taxes you.
The historic university in your city. The multinational bank that holds your mortgage. How much of their current prestige, their massive endowments, and their accumulated advantage is built on historical foundations that remain completely unaccounted for in their public ledgers?
The inheritance is everywhere once you know how to read the balance sheet.
Exactly. And the defining challenge is whether those institutions will finally acknowledge the responsibilities that are inextricably linked to the wealth they inherited.
Absolutely.
But I want to leave you with a final provocative thought. Dr. Saisley applied this framework of extraction, infrastructure, and debt reversal to the historical empires of the 18th and 19th centuries.
Right.
But look closely at the global power structures of our current era. Look at the massive multinational technology monopolies operating today.
Oh, this is a very interesting parallel.
Right now, they are relentlessly extracting our personal data, harvesting our attention, scraping our creative labor, and absorbing our collective digital output to train and build their proprietary multi-trillion dollar AI models.
They are undeniably constructing a modern infrastructure of extraction.
Yes. And they tell us constantly that they are providing us with free platforms, frictionless connection, and the digital roads we need to walk on to participate in modern society.
Just like the imperial ports and railways.
Exactly. But decades from now, when we fully comprehend the profound structural damage done to our social fabric, our privacy, our democratic institutions, or our mental health, how will the ledger be calculated?
Who pays for the repair?
Will these tech empires claim that we are actually in debt to them for building the digital infrastructure? Will they present themselves as benevolent investors who gifted us the future while systematically hiding the immense wealth and life capacity they extracted from our daily existence?
When the final accounts are tallied.
Will the sacrifice of the digital age be told to thank the Silicon Altar? It is something to deeply consider. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive into a truly remarkable essay. Keep reading, keep questioning the ledgers, and keep exploring the hidden structures of the world around you. We will see you next time.